Hi, I'm Chuck Seckinger, and welcome to Labor Relation Gigs in Small Bites. In this podcast, we will concentrate on the union construction market and explain all you need to know to understand the labor relations practices that are so unique to this industry. And we'll do it one step at a time in small bites. So let's go. Hello again. I'm going to be talking about construction union trade jurisdiction and what it is all about. The first question you might have is, what is trade jurisdiction and how did it start as a practice in the union construction industry? As you remember in episode one in the labor history section, I mentioned the formation of the American Federation of Labor and each union's autonomy being recognized for their unique jurisdiction of the work they performed or over their members. I said the autonomy of the union was to be granted a certain jurisdiction over their skill or craft workforce and not be rated by rival unions for their members. That is a very generalized definition of jurisdiction. But before we go on to further unpack the term of union trade jurisdiction, I want to talk some about the several ways the term jurisdiction is used in the union construction industry lexicon. The first and simplest reference is to a geographical jurisdiction. Each local union has a certain geographical jurisdiction, usually defined in their collective bargaining agreements, that calls out the region that a local union covers for their international union. This could be defined as a statewide or multi-state or even by province in Canada. In the states, geographical jurisdiction of a local union is most commonly defined by counties, cities, or municipality boundaries, or even longitude and latitude. The point here is that a local union has a defined geographical region where that particular local can claim their exclusive jurisdiction as the representative of their international union. And the addition of these geographical areas will include all the entire regions of the United States and Canada. Some international unions even claim jurisdiction in some miscellaneous Caribbean islands and even some U.S. territories too. If you need to know, for example, which electrician's local union covers a construction project in a specific county or city, you can go to the international union's website, like ibew.org, and there you will find a directory of their local unions defining each one's unique geographical jurisdiction that it covers by state, county, city, or region. The second way the term jurisdiction is used in the union construction industry is in a very broad sense of defining the totality of the work that international union performs. If you ask which unions work on wood, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters would claim exclusive jurisdiction on any construction material made of wood or even products that once were wood and now are made of a different material, such as ceiling tile, metal door, and window frames, to mention just a few. If you ask who works on steel beams, the ironworkers would immediately claim their jurisdiction. However, down through the years, a number of exceptions have been made based upon engineered purpose of the metal beam. Like, is it a structural steel support for a building? Then it goes to the ironworker's jurisdiction. But if it's a component piece of a boiler, then it's probably going to be installed by the boilermakers. And if it is used to support pipes only, then the installation of the beam would probably go to the pipe fitters. My point here is that the trade term jurisdiction can be used in a very broad sense to include all the recognized work in the union construction industry that is customarily performed by a certain international union. The third way the term jurisdiction is used in the union construction lexicon is the most complicated way and the most confounding for the industry. Trade jurisdiction is the assignment of work by a contractor to an individual union, such as the placement of concrete, the building of scaffold, or the installation of a boiler and piping system. The assignment of work by the contractor must be a consistent practice from the past to the present because of decisions that were handed down possibly over 100 years ago, coming from recognized jurisdictional tribunal awards boards and agreed to by labor and management. I will describe those tribunals in impartial forms later on in this episode. These types of work assignments are based on what is called decisions of record. Or another type of work assignment to a union by a contractor could have been the result of a voluntary agreement, again, made many years ago, between two or several unions for certain type of installations or tasks in an effort to end a recurring dispute between the unions that possibly happened on many construction projects. These are called agreements between the trades. Another work assignment origin could be by honoring agreements that were made between the unions in a specific geographical area. These are called area agreements, or finally, the establishment of an area practice where there is no history of a formal agreement, but the work has been traditionally performed in a particular manner by a certain union or unions. All of that I have described as what is called the criteria for making jurisdictional assignments, either based on decisions of record, agreements between the trades, area agreements, or area practices. You're probably now asking yourself, why are work assignments made this way in the present if the criteria used for them are based in practices that took place over a century ago? Well, again, remember in episode one, I mentioned that the building trade unions in the AFL really came into their own with the advent of construction of the steel frame skyscraper buildings starting in the 1880s in major American cities. There were a number of skilled unions and unskilled unions, each vying for a piece of the pie over which union would be used to install these new technologies of their day. Control over the jurisdiction of the installations resulted in more hours of employment for union members, more money going into their pensions, training funds, and health and welfare funds. Contractors and building developers bought up large quantities of materials and equipment to build these new multi-floor skyscrapers. Materials such as large panel windows, metal door frames, central heating and ventilation systems, and elevators and escalator mechanical systems. What resulted was, as you can imagine, sweetheart deals between these entrepreneurs and the established unions. That led to as few as one union, or as many as three unions, needed to build these new steel frame structures. A tri-party alliance was formed between the carpenters, the bricklayers, and the electrical workers. Not only did these three unions represent a majority of the organized building trades workers, they were also large craft industrial unions, willing and able to expand their jurisdiction to keep up with the technology changes. All were members of the American Federation of Labor, but they caused a wedge between the newer specialty unions that were also members of the AFL and what looked like a power play to grab more work hours for their members at the expense of other affiliated unions. In other words, another form of raiding, which the AFL was adamantly against. The powerful unions took the work from the weaker unions during this period of the early 1900s, and wildcat jurisdictional work stoppages were rampant in the major metropolitan burgeoning construction markets. Something had to be done to save the organized skilled construction unions that were under attack by unskilled industrial unions that operated with only one union to do the same thing as multiple building trades unions or even non-union contractors who could promise that work would not be interrupted by costly work rule wildcat strikes. Also, the AFL skilled unions continued to vie for power, and some unions merged to assure their existence. And along with those mergers came their jurisdiction. This merger ended some of the ongoing disputes between the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and the Amalgamated Woodworkers Union, and between the plumbers and the steamfitters unions. The new technologies of the high-rise buildings were forming the union jurisdiction. Also, as a result, local building trades councils and national building trades councils began to centralize to end their jurisdictional battles in an effort to save their heavily competed for market share of the construction industry. some of the most notable building trade centralized organizations besides the AFL was the Structural Building Trades Alliance, which was a precursor to the Building Trades Department of the AFL. Each established a method for resolving jurisdictional disputes among their affiliated unions, either by a joint conference or executive decisions. However, all these noble attempts were unenforceable, and again, the strong unions won out in the battle for expanded jurisdiction. Finally, by 1919, the Building Trades Department brought the union affiliates back to their senses with the forming of the National Board for Jurisdictional Awards, the NBJA, in the building industry. The NBJA made a landmark ruling to award the placement of reinforced concrete, or rebar as we know it today, to the ironworkers over the lathers, an award that is still accepted as valid to this day. However, the wheels came off the NBJA when they awarded the metal trim to the sheet metal workers over the carpenters, a long-running dispute between these two unions. This award decision was ignored by the UBC, and as a result, the carpenters left the Building Trades Department and thus broke the voluntary settlement forum apart. Again, the power of the unions to picket and strike for their jurisdiction, regardless of logic and awards, won out in the early 20th century. As I mentioned in episode one, there were national war labor boards that were established during World War I and World War II that helped to stabilize the labor relations of the construction industry. However, government started to play a larger role as a construction shareholder with the building of wartime plants and military installations. More regulations were added with the Davis-Bacon Act of 1931 and the National Labor Relations Act, or Wagner Act, of 1935, and the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. More control was needed to be placed on labor, whose numbers had swelled to over 14.3 million workers in 1945, or over 35% of the non-agricultural workforce. Within a three-month period, at the end of 1946 to 1947, the building trades union alone generated 37 work stoppages, which broke down the Building Trades Department's authority to settle jurisdictional disputes using their internal referee system that was in place since the 1930s. The department president yielded the authority to render final decisions, but no international union was satisfied with this system, which ended up with rulings that were again ignored and unenforceable as previously. Clearly, some other way had to be created, or the government was likely to take over the jurisdictional award process. In 1948, a joint jurisdictional board to the department's executive council was formed between the Building Trades Department and the Association of General Contractors, AGC, and headed by an impartial chairman. It was called the National Joint Plan for the Settlement of Jurisdictional Disputes, and the impartial chairman was Harvard labor economist John T. Dunlap, who was previously a member of the FDR's National War Labor Board and went on to be appointed Secretary of Labor under the Gerald Ford administration. Professor Dunlap headed the National Joint Board for the next 9 years, bringing a great deal of stability to the jurisdictional adjudication process. Also during this period, Professor Dunlap was mediating more than 35 national agreements that allowed the international unions to settle their disputes directly and without resorting to the National Joint Board. The goal during this period was to resolve jurisdictional disputes within the Building Trades Department rather than through government intervention from the National Labor Relations Board 10K hearing process that was initiated by the Taft-Hartley Act. I will talk more about the NLRB's 10K hearing process further on in this episode. I went through all this labor history again just to answer the question of how trade jurisdiction started in the building trades. As you have heard, it started out with at the beginning in the late 1880s and has continued down through each decade to today. When you talk about trade jurisdiction with a union rep, be prepared for a pretty impassioned speech about the pride of craftsmanship that each member has in their trade, how it was taught to them through their elders in the apprenticeship program, and how they are handing it down to the next generation of union members. It is something to be protected so that the same job opportunities that were afforded members through the years are still available to members in the future. You will often hear the union reps say they want nothing more than what is their jurisdiction and do not want to take any of the jurisdiction away from another union. However, we have seen that in the beginning, the jurisdiction went to the strongest union that could take it by their numbers or defiance. And then as the years passed, when it became endangered by constant infighting, jurisdiction was moderated by disputes, tribunals, and mediation to become a settled body of decisions of record, agreements between the trades, and area agreements and practices that it is today. Mostly today, jurisdictional disputes leading to work interruptions in the union construction industry is a non-issue. If you would like to archive these decisions of records, agreements between the trades, and area agreements, you will need to get the following source documents. First, start with what is known as the Green Book, which can be found on the NAPTU.org website under the tab Field Services, and then drop down to the Plan for the Settlement of Jurisdictional Disputes in the Construction Industry, or for short, the PLAN. This PDF document details the current state-of-the-art program, as it was last revised in 2011, for the resolution of jurisdictional disputes between or among building trades unions and contractors. I will talk about the rules and regulation of this three-level plan a little later in this episode. At the back of the plan booklet are a number of past decisions of record and agreements between the trades, and from page 39 to 176, you will find them. But that is not at all the complete jurisdictional library. The Association of Union Contractors, or TOC, offers a complete three-volume set of all jurisdictional disputes, agreements between the trades, and area agreements for only $800. A number of in-depth jurisdictional guides can be received directly from the unions, such as Info 67, an agreement between the Boilermakers and the UA Pipefitters that detail boiler and piping systems in powerhouses and chemical plants, with a variety of drawings to illustrate their agreements. When you review all these documents, you will see that the parties to these decisions refer to the past presidents of the Building Trades Department, the National Board of Jurisdictional Awards, NBJA, and John Dunlap's National Joint Board. Oh, the history of the building trades and the saga that finally leads to keeping the jurisdictional piece within their ranks. Now, how is this all applied in the union construction industry? Let's go back to the plan, which sets out rules and regulations for fair play when it comes to implementing trade jurisdiction. Under the plan, it is the contractor's responsibility to make assignments for tasks essential to the completion of the project construction. If certain work packages are subcontracted to a sub-tier contractor, then it is that sub-tier contractor's responsibility to make the work assignments for the work performed by the craft that they will hire. Once the assignment is made, the contractor must stick to that assignment of work and not change it unless told by the unions that a resolution has been made between the union initially assigned the work and the union claiming the work, or by a plan arbitration decision. The union's responsibility under the plan, first and foremost, is that they stay on the job with no strikes, work stoppages, or picketing arising out of any jurisdictional dispute. Again, the union is to stay on the job and process their claim with their international office. If no resolution can be found among the unions and the contractor, then after the claim has been properly sent to the plan administrator, the parties have 5 days to settle, or after that, any of the parties may move the claim to arbitration. Upon selection of the arbitrator then has 7 days to conduct a hearing. The arbitrator has 3 days to issue a decision after the case is closed. The arbitrator must rule on the basis of the criteria established by the plan, which is, again, decisions of record, the existing agreements between the trades, area agreements, or area practices. Only when none of the criteria apply Only then can the arbitrator consider other factors like efficiency, cost or continuity, and good management essential to the well-being of the industry, or in the interest of consumers or past practices of the contractor. The plan arbitrator is not authorized to make back pay awards, and the decision is enforceable in courts. Now, how did this all work in a practical sense? Well, as I will cover in our next episode on collective bargaining agreements and PLAs, you will see that provisions in these types of labor agreements require the contractor and the unions to be stipulated to the plan. That means all parties to a jurisdictional dispute have acknowledged their willingness to settle such issues using the plan's rules and regulations. Part of the stipulation is that the contractor will make work assignments in accordance with the plan, and that means using their best judgment to apply the precedent of the plan's criteria to their project. All decisions of record, existing agreements between the trades, area agreements, and area practices are used by the contractor to make their work assignments. At a pre-job conference held prior to the project's mobilization, the contractor will list all of their work assignments on what is called a markup and disclose to the union which craft they have selected, for example, to rig, unload and install equipment, pour concrete foundations, cut raceways, deliver materials on site, operate dozers, cranes, and miscellaneous small equipment, and dozens of other items. The contractor will provide the appropriate engineering drawings for the unions to view and aid them in the process of illustrating and understanding why the contractor was making the assignment to one union over the other. The union will review their own jurisdictional documents and compare them to the drawings. As you might expect, this is not a cut and dry experience. There is plenty of room for interpretation, and claims are usually made for area practice over the contractor's announced work assignments. The contractor most likely will give a 10-day period to allow for the unions that claim any misassignment to bring forward to the contractor for their review any documentation submitted from the claiming union or assigned union as to why the contractor got it wrong or right and the work was misassigned or properly assigned to the trade. These submittals can be testimonial letters from previous contractors that assigned the same type of work in the area to the claiming union or in support of the contractor's assignment. During this 10-day interim period, the assignments are considered as tentative, and the contractor may change the assignment if convinced by the documentation submitted by the unions. After the 10-day period has expired, the contractor must declare that the assignment disclosed at the pre-job conference or any sidebar meeting thereafter are now final work assignments, and the project's work will start on that basis. At this point, the contractor's assignments are locked in, and they cannot be changed. Plan rules and regulations would come into play here if the dispute was unresolved after the local union rep and the international reps have had a discussion, then it could be moved by any of the parties to the plan arbitration. As I mentioned earlier in this episode, the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB, have an alternative adjudication process for jurisdictional disputes arising in the construction industry. The Taft-Hartley Act added this remedy called a 10K hearing, which allows the board's rulings on jurisdictional disputes where the parties are not bound to a voluntary method of adjustment such as the plan. However, the NLRB does not make their decision using the plan's criteria, that is, the precedent of decisions of record, agreements between the trade, area agreements, or area practice. The board's decisions are made almost always in favor of the contractor's assigned work based on efficiency and skill. The 10K hearing process can be lengthy for a project waiting for a decision. Oftentimes, the unions or contractors will relinquish their claim in favor of an expedited voluntary method, such as the plan or a handshake settlement. What are some of the work assignments that are most commonly contested by unions as jurisdictional disputes? Stanford University Civil Engineering Department conducted a survey with contractors and owners participating. The top five leading reasons for jurisdictional disputes on a job site were, number one, material handling support being the most common, which trade rigs at delivery, stores material, or gets it to the installation point. Number two, setting equipment, which union is responsible for getting the equipment set on its anchor bolts. Number three, operation of small equipment, like pumps, compressors, welding machines, and light plants. Who maintains, fuels, and moves this equipment? Number four, power rigging of material and equipment, again, related to number one. Number five, installation of supports, restraints, and backing, such as a single support for pipe or electrical, or multiple purpose supports carrying both pipe and electrical and compressed air. What does the future hold for trade jurisdiction? Can it sustain another 100 years in the construction industry? Is it archaic or timeless, a study of power and strength, as it was in the late 1800s to the early 1900s, or one of mediation and compromise, like it was in the 1940s to present day, with impartial adjudication forums leading the way? Well, we will see as technology, robotics, and new equipment and material appear in the future. All new challenges for the union construction industry survival in the 21st century. I hope you enjoyed Episode 2, Trade Jurisdictions, and learned something that will help you understand this complex subject. Thank you for listening, and come back for Episode 3, PLAs and CBAs, where I will talk about the conditions of typical collective bargaining agreements in the union construction industry and dig into their working terms and conditions. Until then, be safe and best wishes. References for this episode came from Skilled Hands, Strong Spirits, Grace Palladino, Cornell University Press, 2005. Craft Jurisdictional Guide, National Erectors Association, 5th Revision, July 1990. Labor in the American Community, Derek C. Balk, John T. Dunlap, Simon & Schuster Press, 1970. Exclusive Jurisdiction in Construction, a Construction Industry Cost-Effectiveness Project Report, the Business Roundtable, Report C1, July 1982. I'm Chuck Seckinger, Principal Consultant with Labor Relations Gigs. You can find more episodes at www.laborrelationgigs.com. Thank you for listening. Bye.